Hello and welcome. It is Eric Erickson here. I'm actually in an actual radio studio today. Usually I'm in my bunker. This is profound. Welcome. The phone number is 877-97-ERIC, 877-973-7425. It's a good thing, too, because the lawn guys typically have been coming in the mornings to my house because they use the leaf blower right by the window of my studio. And everybody says you can barely even notice it. If I'm talking, you can't notice it at all, but I'm always self-conscious. And my wife just texted me that they had just showed up, and so I'm glad I'm here in the confines. Now the fire alarm or something will go off. All right, we've got news. So I got to shift gears a little bit from what I was going to talk about because this is breaking news happening right now. Senator Chuck Schumer's aides, his staff, have announced an agreement on reconciliation to get reconciliation passed. They've come up with ways to finance their reconciliation plan. So I want to explain these things to you, but here, I got to get to the punchline of this. A Kristen Sinema aide has now come out and said, this is the actual direct quote, "It's unclear what Senator Schumer's aide is referring to. We have seen nothing and have signed off on nothing." Ouch. Ouch. Okay, so I want to explain to you the various parts of this, just so you have an idea. So you'll be smarter than your neighbor on this. There are three separate conversations happening, and they're all happening concurrent to one another. They are all connected to one another. The first conversation is reconciliation. Reconciliation. Actually, I guess there are four conversations, but bear with me. So the first conversation is reconciliation. Let me explain to you, those of you who have heard me before, I'm sorry, I'll try not to bore you. We won't spend a long time on this. But years ago, Sheets Bird, Robert Byrd from West Virginia, the former grand wizard of the KKK or whatever he was in the Senate, Democrat, of course, being a Klansman, and he announced that they needed a way to alter the budget without the budget being held hostage to the filibuster. So he devised a rule wherein you could reconcile appropriations matters to a budget, and that reconciliation would allow for the Senate to vote without the filibuster. So as long as you're passing an appropriations reconciliation, it's not new appropriations. It conforms to a budget. And the budget, by the way, can't be filibustered either. So you're reconciling things to that budget framework. Then you can pass under reconciliation with a majority of the Senate and it can't be filibustered. Now, how does this work? There are a couple of parameters. One, what you're doing in reconciliation is you pass a non-filibusterable budget framework and says the budget for the coming year is going to be adjusted by $5 trillion. Then you separately pass a reconciliation package, and the reconciliation package rearranges the federal budget to meet that $5 trillion. It can't be filibustered, but there's a catch. You cannot add anything into it that will increase the debt or deficit, and you cannot attach anything that would be a new policy for the United States. So, for example, the last time Democrats tried reconciliation, they wanted to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. The Senate parliamentarian ruled that would actually be a new policy for the United States. Therefore, you can't do that. This time, they wanted to put in amnesty for illegal aliens. The Senate parliamentarian said, "We're sorry. This is a brand new policy. It deviates from current American policy. Therefore, you can't do it." So those things had to be thrown out. So now they're trying to throw things in, the Green New Deal and the other stuff. But what they have to do is they've got to raise taxes in order to do it. Because keep in mind, there are two components to passing something through reconciliation. One, it can't be a change to major U.S. policy. And two, it can't negatively impact the debt and deficit. So if you want to, for example, build a bunch of bridges in the country, that's going to affect the debt and deficit unless you're cutting something else, or you're raising taxes, one or the other. it's a tax increase, or it's a cut somewhere else. So you put all of these things together in reconciliation, and they have to have what are called pay-fors. Everything you want to spend has to be accompanied by either a tax increase or a cut from somewhere else to pay for the new thing. And then it can get through the Senate without the filibuster. You can only do this once a fiscal year. The Senate parliamentarian, however, gave the Senate Democrats a chance for a second bite at the apple by saying if they fundamentally change the federal budget, they can then do a second reconciliation package. That's what they're doing. So they've already done one reconciliation. Now they're doing a second reconciliation. The problem is that they want to spend $3.5 trillion with it, and they want to fundamentally transform the United States with what they're doing, from the Green New Deal to they're now calling it a human infrastructure plan. They want to do a bunch of expansions of existing federal programs. Now, the Senate parliamentarian has ruled expansions of existing programs are not new policies. Therefore, they can do these things because they're just growing Medicare. They're growing Medicaid. They're growing other government programs. That's reconciliation. It passes the Senate. It has to go to the House. If the House changes anything, they have to honor what's called the Byrd rule in the Senate on reconciliation. Why? Because if they change something, it's got to go back to the Senate. If something has changed, it suddenly becomes filibusterable unless it again adheres to the Byrd rule. So the Senate, in other words, is able to run roughshod over the House. House members hate it. As much as Republicans and Democrats in the House can't stand each other, they view each other as opponents and the Senate as the enemy. And it makes them livid that they have to adhere to the Byrd rule, which the House doesn't have, and yet they're stuck. Reconciliation, that's conversation number one. Conversation number two is the debt ceiling. The Congress has decided that the federal government can only take on so much debt. There's been a movement for a while to get rid of the debt ceiling and just let it go up as needed, but no one's ever been able to agree with it because it allows the minority party a weapon against the majority party to accuse them of raising the debt of the United States. Voters can't stand that we keep raising debt, even though voters would even hate more if we raise taxes, but it becomes a political fight. The Democrats have to raise the debt ceiling because they want to spend $5.5 trillion between their reconciliation package and a bipartisan infrastructure bill. And as a result of this, they're going to hit the debt ceiling. Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary, says she expects we'll hit the debt ceiling sometime in November. So Congress has to vote to raise the debt ceiling. Now, the way the media and the Democrats talk about this is that we will default on our debt if they don't raise the debt ceiling. That is, the federal government is required under the Constitution to honor the debts of the United States, the full faith and credit clause. And if they can't raise the debt ceiling, they can't take out debt. Therefore, they can't have money coming through short of tax revenue, and there's not enough tax revenue. Therefore, they can't pay the debts. That's not really true. The way the rule actually works is that if you hit the debt ceiling and it's not raised, the Treasury Secretary has to take money from the general tax reserves and send it to pay the debt. So you may not get your Social Security check. You may not get your Medicaid. You may not get your Medicare. You may not get money for your local school. You may not get defense appropriations. You may not get all the stuff the Congress has appropriated because all that stuff now has to go to service the debt of the United States, which is actually the largest part of the budget. So we're not actually going to default. They want to make it sound like there's a default. I'm sure the Biden administration is working with Moody's right now to lower our credit rating so he can blame it on the Republicans. But there's plenty of money to pay the debt. The catch is you just can't pay for anything else you're supposed to pay for. That's the debt ceiling fight. The Republicans are refusing to raise it. They're refusing to raise it because the reason for it to be raised is the Democrats' reconciliation. The Democrats have cut the Republicans out of the reconciliation process. So the Republicans are saying, you don't want us part of that process. We're not going to be a part of the debt ceiling. You're going to need to put it into the reconciliation process. If the Democrats put the debt ceiling increase into the reconciliation process, they have to cut things. Why? Because you cannot increase the debt or deficit in reconciliation. If you do, it becomes filibusterable. So if you raise the debt ceiling by $3 trillion, you're pretty much scuttling everything else the Democrats want to do, because otherwise you're raising debt $3 trillion, and it's got to be debt and deficit neutral. So if the Democrats fold the debt ceiling into reconciliation, they have to scrap more than half of what they intend to do, the Green New Deal and all that stuff. It goes out the window. The Democrats are insisting that the Republicans instead join them in raising the debt ceiling, as it's their obligation to honor the full faith and credit of the United States. And they say, well, the reason we're having to raise the debt ceiling is because Donald Trump spent so much. But the Democrats went along with a lot of that spending, too. And the Republicans are not going along with any of the reconciliation spending. So all of the Senate Republicans, from Susan Collins to Lisa Murkowski to Mitt Romney to even the Democrats, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, are opposed to raising the debt ceiling unless it's lumped into reconciliation, and it's not happening. So Sinema and Manchin are trying to force budget cuts in reconciliation. The Democrats, in other words, do not have enough of their own votes to pass reconciliation right now. Sinema and Manchin are opposed, and in large part they're opposed because of the debt ceiling fight. The Republicans aren't going to raise the debt ceiling in the House or the Senate. They're just not going to. Keep in mind, in the House, they can only lose 3 votes on the Democratic side. So that's fight number 2. You got the reconciliation fight and you got the debt ceiling fight, and they are directly connected, because you pass reconciliation in the spending package, they do need to raise the debt ceiling. You raise the debt ceiling and it impacts everything, and it allows the Democrats the ability to spend all the money they've appropriated. The Republicans are saying no. So now the Democrats are weaving conversation 3 into it. That is the continuing resolution. In addition to needing to raise the debt ceiling — are y'all confused yet? You should be, because it's a mess. In addition to needing to raise the debt ceiling, they also need to fund the government. Now, a continuing resolution is very simple. It takes all the money that's currently being spent and extends it based on percentages. There are no new spending. There are no spending cuts. You're just continuing what's already being there. And this continuing resolution runs out at the end of October. Or mid-October. So if they don't pass a new continuing resolution by the middle of October, the government shuts down. The Democrats have decided to tie the continuing resolution and the debt ceiling together, trying to force the Republicans to vote for both. Otherwise, they can blame the Republicans for causing default and causing shutdown. The Republicans aren't taking the bait. They don't care. Their argument is, y'all control everything. You can get this without a filibuster and reconciliation. We're not going along with it. The Democrats are actually — now John Yarmuth, a moderate Democrat from Kentucky, who's in charge of, I think, Ways and Means, one of the big committees of the House, is saying, we're running out of time. We're not going to have time to pass a clean continuing resolution or a clean debt ceiling piece of legislation. Actually, it's very easy to draft. You just say, we are continuing the budget of the United States as it was, period, the end. It's a one sheet of paper. You don't have to write a 1,000-word or 1,000-page continuing resolution. You don't have to. The Democrats want to complicate it. Why? Because the Democrats believe the only way they're going to get any of this stuff passed is to cause a crisis. So they're steering the United States directly into a financial crisis at the federal level, trying to put pressure on the Republicans to vote for the debt ceiling and the continuing resolution, because both of them are filibusterable in the Senate. And the Republicans, they're not having any of it. They're telling the Democrats, y'all created this mess. You get yourselves out of it. We didn't. You shut us out of everything. You shut us out of the debt debate. You shut us out of reconciliation. You shut us out of everything. So y'all fix this yourselves. You have the means to do it with reconciliation. We're sorry that's going to screw up the rest of your agenda, but we're not helping you screw up America. The Republicans are doing the right things, digging their heels in, saying no way. The Democrats are intentionally at this point steering the ship of state into a financial crisis to try to force Republican votes. They think they're playing a game of chicken. Mitch McConnell is not playing chicken. The Republicans aren't going to go along with this. And the Democrats, the fact they can't realize that, tells you everything about how bad they are at governing right now.
Americans continue to navigate through multiple crises this year,
We the People, a Bradley speaker series, offers insights and ideas on the current challenges we face from some of the remarkable organizations the Bradley Foundation supports. Visit bradleyfdn.org/liberty to watch their most recent episode, which features Stephen Sokup, author of The Dictatorship of Woke Capital, How Political Correctness Captured Big Business, an Encounter Books publication. In this episode, Sokup discusses the left's gradual takeover of corporate America and why the free market hasn't been able to prevent it, the dangerous impact of shareholder activism, and efforts to push back on it. That's Bradley with an L-E-Y at the end, fdn.org/liberty to watch the video. New episodes debut weekly, so go back often, subscribe to their YouTube channel. Be notified when new ones are posted. That's bradleyfdn.org/liberty. Hello there, it is Eric Erickson here. The phone number is 877-97-ERIC, 877-973-7425. I told you they're having four conversations in Washington. If you're just tuning in, I've been trying to break down the conversations that are happening in Washington as we head towards a fiscal cliff. The first conversation is over reconciliation. The second conversation is over the debt ceiling. The third conversation is over the continuing resolution to continue funding the government so we don't have a government shutdown. And the fourth is the bipartisan infrastructure legislation. I need to explain this one to you. The Democrats and Republicans in Washington in the Senate came up with a bipartisan infrastructure plan. The Democrats decided they would put everything else they wanted that the Republicans wouldn't go along with in this reconciliation package, which is one reason why the Republicans aren't willing to help on the debt ceiling or anything else, because they didn't want any of this stuff. The Democrats shut them out of the process and said, look, we put all this stuff in one and we'll put everything else we like in another. And then Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi came out and said, well, you're going to have to pass them both or we're not going to sign the bipartisan one into law. Well, that pissed off Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema and all the Republicans. So Biden walked it back and said, well, actually, OK, I misspoke. Yeah, I'm willing to consider signing the bipartisan one, even if you don't pass the other one. Nancy Pelosi didn't. She said, nope, no way. Joe Biden got a hold of her and said, you got to walk this back, too. So Pelosi walked it back. But who's not walking it back? The progressive House members. Jayapal, Omar, Tlaib, Ocasio-Cortez, they're all saying if you don't pass them both, it's all or nothing. It's either $5 trillion or it's zero. And the moderates, they miscalculated the moderates. The moderates in the House representatives are saying, all right, better nothing than all of that. We're going to lose otherwise. Now, this goes back to something I was saying yesterday. The so-called squad, they've never been in the minority in the House. They came in 2018. They've never been in the minority. They don't know what it's like. A lot of the moderate members in the House who would rather nothing than $5 trillion have been in the minority, and they understand there's a problem here. There's a problem. And now you've got Joe Manchin saying, I'm not giving you $3 trillion. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is attacking him in the paper and on TV regularly, saying he's in the pocket of the oil business, and he's not budging. The result is an impasse for the Democrats in Washington, D.C. They can't get the bipartisan infrastructure plan passed in the House. Representative Jayapal has come out and said, we're not going to pass it. And we're not even going to support the continuing resolution right now. We want the whole kit and caboodle passed or else. So now you're in this weird situation where it is the progressives in the House who are willing to shut down the federal government and risk default on the nation's credit, not that that'll really happen, in order to get everything passed. Here's what they know that no one else appreciates. The National Press Corps will support the progressives and blame everyone else, because the National Press Corps is more or less aligned with them over anyone else. The result is they think they've got the clout to get this done, and I don't know that they actually do at this point. There's increasing frustration with the progressives blocking the bipartisan plan that everyone agreed to. When we come back, it gets even better. The murder and the crime and the police.
If you've been behind the wheel of a high-performance sports car, you realize how much better a car can be. You never want to settle for a regular car again. I feel that way with my X-Chair. From the moment I first sat down in it and I understood how many consider X chair to be the finest office chair in the world. Can your current office chair give you a massage while you're working? My X chair can. And as a guy in radio who sits in this chair for 3 hours a day, plus an additional 3 hours doing show prep, I can tell you it's worth it. It can also heat up. It can cool down. That's what my X chair can do. I bet yours can't. It's all the Elevax massage and temperature regulation, exclusively designed and made for X chair. Once you feel it, once you realize the difference, you're not going to go back. You're going to want one of these. Try X chair yourself, risk-free for 30 days. Once you realize how much better your chair can be, you're never going to go back. I promise. I didn't. And I had a really fancy chair. And then I got my X chair. There's no going back. Go to xchaireric.com now with the letter X, chair, E-R-I-C-K.com for $100 off your order. X chair has a 30-day guarantee of complete comfort. It's xchaireric.com. I got to send one out, don't I? I forgot to do that yesterday. I will get one out. The phone number is 877-973-7425. It is Eric Erickson here. You're more than welcome to call in. We got to talk about the crime situation in the country right now. We haven't spent a lot of time on it lately, but it's not going away. In fact, there is some just really terrible data, frankly, out from the New York Times right now on the murder rate in the United States. It has skyrocketed. In fact, the headline, there is no precedent for last year's increase in the murder rate. The previous largest one-year increase was 12.7% in 1968. The murder rate rose by almost 30% in 2020. It's rising at a slower rate in 2021, but still rising. The Uniform Crime Report will stand as the official word on an unusually grim year, detailing a rise in murder of around 29%. The previous largest one-year change was a 12.7% increase in 1968. The national rate, murders per 100,000, still remains about one-third below the rate in the early 90s. The data is scheduled to be released on Monday along with a news release, but it was published early on the FBI's Crime Data Explorer website. The FBI said some numbers could change by Monday as it reviews possible discrepancies and receives updates, but the main conclusions of the data are highly unlikely to change. Separately, an independent analysis of big cities finds at least one promising sign that the murder rate may be starting to flatten this year. The increase in crimes this summer does not appear to be as large as the record spike last summer. Here are the main takeaways. Previously, the largest one-year increase in murder was 1,938 in 1990. The FBI data shows almost 5,000 more murders last year than in 2019, for a total of around 21,500 murders, still below the early 1990s. The reasons for the rise may never be fully sorted out, but analysts have pointed to a number of factors, including pandemic stresses, increased distrust between the public and the police after the murder of George Floyd, including a pullback by the police in response to criticism, and, of course, they're going to say increased firearm carrying. About 77% of reported murders in 2020 were committed with a firearm, the highest share ever reported. The change in murder was widespread, a national phenomenon, not a regional one. Murder rose over 35% in cities with populations over $250,000 that reported full data. It rose over 40% in cities between $100,000 and $250,000 and around 25% in cities under $25,000. No geographic area was spared. The FBI reported in March the murder was up at least 20% in every region of the country, including 30% in the Midwest. Overall, murder was up at least 20% in counties carried by Joe Biden as well as by Donald Trump. One regional factor stayed consistent. Louisiana had the highest murder rate for the 32nd straight year. Murders were also elevated in the first few months of 2020. That increased significantly in June and stayed high through the remainder of the year. But, even with the rise in murders and a roughly 5% increase in violent crime, the new data shows that overall major crimes fell 4 to 5%.
Murder, although it carries the highest societal cost, makes up a tiny portion of major crimes as defined by the FBI. Some of the reduction in overall crime was clearly related to the pandemic. Theft made up around 7 in 10 property crimes. It's hard to commit shoplifting when stores are closed. But overall, crime was dropping long before the pandemic. 2020 was the 18th straight year of declining overall crime. Now, what do you make of all this? There are several things you got to make of it. One is perception becomes reality. Overall, according to the FBI, crime was down last year. But the decrease in crime was only single percentage point declines, while murder was up by double digits. Murder does, as the New York Times said, have the highest societal cost. On top of that, in some parts of the country, though crime was down overall, other crimes increased. And parts of the country are seeing a police revolt against politicians who are blaming the police. It's been national news that here in Atlanta, the financial center of the city is the northern suburb called Buckhead, and they want to become a new city distinct from Atlanta because crime is escalating rapidly up there. There have been an increase in shootings. The mayor of Atlanta pretends that gangs aren't a problem and pretends that crime isn't a problem and has decided she wants to solve the crime problem by creating a new department that is charged with solving crime as if there isn't already a police department. She's thrown the police under the bus repeatedly, and there are triggering instances of criminal behavior throughout the city of Atlanta that she has emboldened and frankly funded. But it's not just here. Minneapolis, Minnesota, they're voting to get rid of their police department in the wake of the George Floyd incident. They want to get rid of their police department. You know who doesn't want to get rid of the police department in Minneapolis? Black citizens. Black citizens are disproportionately affected by crime when police go away from their communities. They don't want to get rid of the police. But the well-meaning white progressives of Minneapolis want to get rid of the police department. And they think they're helping their black citizen neighbors. They think it's loving their neighbors to unleash crime into their communities and save them from the police. White progressives increasingly view police as bad guys and bad guys as innocent. Bad guys are victims too, you know, because they're victims of the white supremacy patriarchy. And the police, even if they're majority minority, they're tools of the white supremacist patriarchy. The result is that people don't feel safe in the United States. Now, we got to layer politics onto this, I'm afraid. And we shouldn't have to. Murder is not political. It's like the Gabby Petito situation. Just to spend a moment on that situation, you've probably heard of it by now, the 22-year-old girl, young, white, blonde, social media influencer, presumably killed by her boyfriend who's now on the run. And news outlets are turning it into a race conversation. They're not dealing with her being murdered. They're dealing with the fact that people care about her being murdered as a sign of racism, and that the media that has the very same media that's covered her, CNN, for example, CNN is running a story today that media outlets, they're covering Gabby Petito, but they don't cover missing black and Hispanic women and murdered black and Hispanic women. Well, CNN, last I checked, is a media outlet. CNN could choose to cover those things. Joy Reid on MSNBC, the progressive talking points regurgitator, she did an entire segment blasting media coverage of Gabby Petito, saying, well, why don't they cover black and Hispanic women who have been murdered? Last I checked, this idiot has a TV show named after herself, where she never chose to cover those topics. Gabby Petito's death is not a metaphor for race in this country. She's just a dead young woman, presumably murdered by her boyfriend. And people in the country don't feel safe. But the media and progressives are turning this into race monologues. They can't help themselves at this point. And they're making decisions and shaping public policy based on not what is good for local communities, not what keeps local communities safe, but what makes people who are particularly progressive, well-to-do and white, feel good about themselves. The murderer in the black inner city community does not care if you white suburban progressives feel good about yourselves in your enclave gated communities because you decided to defund the police. If anything, the murderer thanks you for defunding the police. My studio is in a progressive, wealthy part of Atlanta. You got a 1,500 square foot house, can sell for $800,000, $900,000. Most of the houses around here, the Ansley Park area of Atlanta, they go for millions of dollars. I think the membership fee for the local golf course around here is like something like $80,000. It's something ridiculous. And it's overwhelmingly white, overwhelmingly progressive, and overwhelmingly has Black Lives Matter signs in their yards. And the whole reason they have the Black Lives Matter sign in their yard is it's these white people who are essentially doing in their yards what the Israelites had to do to their doorposts at Passover, is they had to paint them with the sheep's blood so that the angel of death would pass by their houses. These white, rich progressives are putting Black Lives Matter signs in their yard so that if the Black Lives Matter rioters come through their neighborhood, please leave us alone, angels of death and destruction. It's a religious symbolism. There's no difference to the Israelites painting blood on the doorpost in Egypt on the night before their deliverance than it is to put these signs in the yards of white enclaves while these same white people are insistent that you must defund the police in the black community so that people don't feel bad about themselves, so people don't feel oppressed. People don't feel safe. And the media conversation is about why are we covering a dead white girl? You're covering the dead white girl because she was murdered. And she was a social media influencer. And you want the eyeballs that come with that. You want the rating points. You want the people to pay attention. That's why you're covering her. That's why you're not covering the anonymous minority woman who's randomly gunned down in the street because she wasn't a social media influencer, doesn't have the audience you want. That's the truth of the matter. Now, you can blame that on race or not, but it's about advertisers and ratings points and rating shares and why they cover some stories and not other stories. And the story that they've really chosen not to cover is the fact that they can say crime's down 4%, but my God, murder is up double digits. 30%. And people don't feel safe. People can't get their kids to school. If they get their kids to school, the kids got to wear masks. People are maybe walking into losing a job. Maybe they don't have a job. Maybe they're trying to find a job. But service industry businesses, some are closed up now. They don't even exist anymore because nobody showed up for work when they needed them. The economy is a mess. And the Democrats in Washington are in denial about the crime situation. They're in denial about the murder situation. They're in denial about the fact that police are actually good and we need them. They're in denial about the economic situation. They're in denial about inflation. And they're setting up yet another fiscal cliff crisis in this country so that they can blame Republicans because it's all about winning the next election, not actually solving the problems. And they think they need all the credit and the Republicans need all the blame. When murder's up 30%, COVID is not receding. It's going up in northern states now. By the way, did you notice all the brouhaha, the fear, the complaining, the angst over SEC football games and massive crowds at these SEC games? And guess what? 4 weeks into football season and the COVID numbers are going down in all the SEC states. The left is living in fear of COVID while the American public is living in fear of criminals, and the left is steering policy to placate and relax their fears of COVID and totally ignoring that most Americans are just scared of getting shot or mugged in a parking lot these days. And if you've got that fear, the left wants you to think you're a racist. That's not sustainable. And there will be hell to pay at the ballot box. You know, one of the ways that the left is trying to prevent you from taking action against them is they're using companies like a cell phone company called Credo Mobile, where a progressive uses Credo Mobile, and Credo Mobile takes its profits and gives them to left-wing causes and left-wing organizations that help keep getting Democrats elected. Well, there's a way for you to fight back, and there's a way for you to do business with a cell phone company that's not woke, that's not progressive, that's not going to fund causes that you're opposed to. That's to get an account with Patriot Mobile. Patriot Mobile is the nation's only conservative Christian cell phone carrier. Not only that, they do data plans. They use the cell towers that everyone else uses, and they have 100% U.S.-based customer service. So when you talk to them, you're talking to someone in this country. But also, they share your values, and they do give a portion of their profits to causes that you care about, Second Amendment causes. They give a portion of their profits to pro-life causes, to veterans and first responder causes. Somebody reached out to me yesterday, said they rolled their account over, and they got a big discount because they're an NRA member. Patriot Mobile is a great company, and you can get free activation with them by using my name. What you do is you go to patriotmobile.com/Eric. That's patriotmobile.com/Eric, E-R-I-C-K, or you can call them, their U.S.-based customer service team, 972-PATRIOT. Roll over to Patriot Mobile today. Do business with a company that not only shares your values, but puts its money where its mouth is and actually funds the causes you care about. patriotmobile.com/Eric. You know, you should text data to 33777 because I wrote a piece today explaining the Gabby Petito situation, and I realize some of you could not care less about that story. I find it fascinating that much of the media has been guilted into covering it along racial lines when they were first covering it as a legitimate story. But there's a thing here on the Gabby Petito story that you may not realize. A large segment of the population, particularly younger women, are obsessed with true crime stories now. And true crime podcasts are exploding. Even the Babylon Bee caught on to this. They had a headline yesterday, "Guy Being Murdered, Just Glad He's Finally in a Podcast." This is how it begins. "It was while the axe was dropping into his spleen that Tony Marcus realized a lifelong dream was coming true. He'd been a fan of true crime podcasts for years, but never dreamed he'd get to be on one. Now, totally unexpectedly, it was happening." But it's actually the phenomenon is young women really have latched on to true crime. And, I mean, there's always been a market for it. You have the Nancy Grace shows and stuff like that and Unsolved Mysteries and all, but it is coming on with a vengeance in the podcast form. NPR really started it. And so the media has latched on to something like the Gabby Petito story because they're trying to capture those young eyeballs and convert them into watchers for advertisers. That's why it has nothing really to do with race and everything to do with who the advertisers want.